cancel culture made cowards of us all. I'm sad to say that the grown-ups in the room, and people who run institutions and people who are in positions of authority, have accommodated to a lot of this.
Welcome to the Schweizer Monat. Our guest today is Baroness Fox of Buckley. She is a member of the House of the Lords in England, and I'm very happy that she joined us today in our show. So, Baroness, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Now, from now on in, you must call me Claire, because I'm really,
okay,
in real life, Claire Fox, the director of the Academy of Ideas. But yes, thank you. It's delightful to be with you.
Okay, so Claire, thank you for joining us. You are the director of the Academy of Ideas, and therefore I will ask you first, how is, you know, the mental state of free speech in your country?
It isn't very healthy. It's definitely in need of some resuscitation and medical intervention. I don't want to exaggerate, because the issue of free speech in the United Kingdom has become something of a political football, used by the American administration and by Donald Trump and so on. And it can be too easy to go along with the kind of Elon Musk, oh, the police are turning up at everybody's doors every 5 minutes, arresting people for their speech. That is, of course, an exaggeration. But it's based on something real, which is we've become very complacent about the way the law has been used, to, particularly under the auspices of cracking down on hate speech. The whole sections of the criminal law now have parts of them that can mean that hate speech is used as a way of criminalizing what people are arguing. And it's often been weaponized by one's political opponents or just people who don't like you. And unfortunately, the state have lost any sort of instinctive sense of proportion in dealing with that. So that's one side of the story, the way the law is being, I would say, misused, and it needs to be repealed, pulled back, and we need to look very carefully at the legislation. Instead, by the way, we have a government that's increasing the number of hate crime laws. So that's, you know, I'm up against a government that doesn't agree with me. And then secondly, there's an informal atmosphere of a cultural climate of you can't say that. That if you cause offence, that you may well find yourself in difficulties at work, on university campuses, your reputation can be besmirched. It's far too easy now to call people a bigot because you disagree with them, to use this as a way of silencing legitimate and necessary political discussion in any democratic society. And people are walking on eggshells and looking over their shoulder, fearful that somebody will say that what they've said is causing offence.
So you have written a book that the title, I love this title. I still find that offensive. It's the title of the book. So it seems this is it at the head of the time, because, you know, if I hear hate speech, I always ask myself, but who is to define hate? I don't know who is defining hate. Is it the judge? Is it the state? Is it the politicians? Are the politicians? So this title seems really, it struck me. I like this title. It's the book about the hate speech debate, or is it more historical?
That was the second edition. So the first edition was called "I Find That Offensive!" exclamation mark, and the second edition was "I Still Find That Offensive." I wrote the book. It's only a very short book, but I wrote the book very much as a provocation. But it was looking at trends in America, in particular, around what's become known as Generation Snowflake. And I was particularly interested because I do a lot of work at the Academy of Ideas and as a former teacher with young people. And I was just surprised at how many young 16, 17, 18, 19-year-olds were closing down debate. And this is very different on the basis that they wanted to be kept safe from uncomfortable, offensive ideas. And we even had a movement that was a safe space movement. On every university, they would declare safe spaces that people would, it would mean that you would object to or exclude anyone whose views were considered to be unsafe. And of course, when you hear the concept of safety, you think maybe somebody's going to come and hit you, or, you know, turn up with a baseball bat, or, you know, this is kind of frightening. When you realise that these young people were saying they wanted to be safe from dangerous ideas, then obviously there's a reason for us to be concerned about their capacity for resilience on the one hand, and also, exactly as you described in relation to hate speech, who decides what's offensive, who decides what's hateful, and obviously young people in particular who you want to encourage to be intellectually curious and intellectually to take risks and to read widely and to not have developed a fixed opinion that becomes a dogma that you're never allowed to challenge without being accused of being offensive, that for those young people to be retreating away from the exhilarating possibility of new ideas into somewhere where they'd say, I feel safe now because the only views I can hear are those echoing my own, was going to be a recipe for ignorance, philistinism, and anti-democratic trends towards censorship. And that's what I was interested in. That's what I wrote the book about. And I was issuing a warning call from American campus universities in particular. And I was accused, I mean, the book sold very well, but I was accused by my detractors of exaggeration. Actually, I think I completely underestimated how far this would go. I mean, I wrote it before cancel culture was even a term that we used, before the words woke were ever used. And so you, in fact, I was anticipating a trend that I could see, and I'm afraid that trend is still well and truly with us.
Yeah, it seems crazy time. And the question, I think, is, is there a right to be to not to be offended, or a right to feel safe? Is there a right in a democracy, in a free
society? Well, I don't think there is. There's certainly no natural right. But the problem with which I've now discovered as a legislator and a lawmaker is that actually the law can back up some of these overly sensitive feelings, because actually in hate crime legislation, there's no definition of hate. In fact, there is a definition, which is that a hate crime will be defined by the victim. I mean, can you imagine? So this is a very dangerous situation, because you can feel as though somebody is being hateful towards you, and that will be enough. And that's the basis on which the police can intervene. And it's also true that we have a different problem, of a definitional problem, which is what is harmful. Now, we're all, you know, and those of us who are familiar with J.S. Mill, who is the kind of famous champion of free speech from the 19th century, says, you know, I believe in, you know, unfettered free speech, but he has something called the harm principle, unless that speech would cause harm. And he uses the example of if somebody cries fire in a crowded theatre, which would lead to a riot. The problem with that concept of harm, his very narrow exception of harm, is that harm is now much more loosely defined from physical harm, from concrete harm, to psychological harm. And another thing which has occurred in the recent decades, which has really muddied the waters, is this concept of pathologizing and medicalizing in many ways harm. And it's an ever expansive term. So young people at university will say that if they hear a speaker they find has hateful, offensive speech involved, i.e. speech they don't agree with, which they find personally difficult to listen to, they will say that it triggers in them post-traumatic stress disorder. So they've basically adopted the language of psychiatric care, serious mental health problems, and made it their own as part of their defense mechanism. And they really do believe, I mean, it's not even a con. They really believe that if they are exposed to ideas which they find uncomfortable, that it will damage their psyche. And the problem is, for me, that you could kind of write this off as youthful, you know, kind of lack of experience of the world, except that that definition of psychological harm is on the UK statute books. It's in the law. So the recent Online Safety Act uses a very woolly definition of harm, and it says psychological harm is part of that. So, of course, once you get into that, then anyone can claim that they've been harmed by speech. So whereas I can assert to you that there should be, and in my view, there is no natural right not to be offended, the way that the mission creep of law has allowed these concepts, these cultural concepts, to become incorporated into the law, it means that there's a green light for the legislators, criminal justice system, for the police, for the courts, to actually take these things into consideration. And that's been very damaging to free speech.
Mm-hmm. Talking about the battle of ideas, I've learned that, you know, the more that our mind and our souls are challenged, the more that they are uncomfortable with themselves, looking forward for the better solution, the better me, the better version of ideas, the better version of being together and sharing ideas, the better society will be, the open, more openness. And now it seems that it's the other way around. The safer the people, the safer the soul, the safer the spirit, the more close you have, the kids, you know, they have to be safe in their thinking and they have to be in their bubble, and then they are safe. It seems the other way around. So anthropologists would say, from enlightenment, the ideas of enlightenment, and we have to be uncomfortable to learn, to grow. Now we have, you know, this shrinking idea of, I don't know how, where these ideas come from. Is it Marxism all again, or is it something else?
It's more the kind of postmodern turn in a way, and there's a long history of how intellectually we arrived at this point, one which we should explore at some point. But, you know, you mentioned the Enlightenment in a positive sense, as would I, and I consider myself to be the inheritor of the great gains of the Enlightenment. But, you know, if I was of a certain mindset, I would accuse you of Eurocentric thinking that doesn't understand that the Enlightenment, created by now dead white men of privilege, set up the way that we think and what we consider to be knowledge and valid and so on in a particular way to exclude minorities. You know, that would be what they would say. And one of the things that's occurred, I mean, I suppose that we need to make an important part of this conversation, is that the notion that we are all equal before the law, or that there's any such thing as universal truths, has been dismissed as a con. And there has been the fragmentation of the notion of, you know, the citizens of a country, or even us as humanity, into different identity groups. And one of the things that's most disconcerting for somebody like me, because I'm actually from, you know, a left-wing background. In fact, I was the publisher of Living Marxism, so I'm definitely not owning the mess that we've got into on this. But the left, however, my erstwhile peers, did in fact accommodate to the growth of these identity groups. They kind of abandoned trying to build a universal party on the left. I mean, they kind of became disillusioned with the working class in the United Kingdom, and they kind of went for a rainbow alliance. Oh, well, you know, ethnic minorities or lesbians and gays, or, you know, and so on and so forth. And they started to see people through these inherent characteristics, and this has mushroomed out of all proportion. We also, this sat alongside multiculturalism as a political policy. Now, I want to be very clear here. This is not the same as multi-ethnic society. There's always been immigration into the United Kingdom, however controversial it is at the moment. There's always been a degree of multi-ethnic integration in the United Kingdom. But multiculturalism was a policy decision to say that you should respect different identity groups. And respect came to be termed that you could not criticize different identity groups. And this, alongside this identity politics, has created almost a competition for victim status. Because you actually, mm-hmm. if you are an identity group with a victim status, you can access, first of all, you can demand that people are silent and don't criticize you. So my phrase, I find that offensive, is always started off with, as a woman, I find that offensive. And that's not somebody telling you that. That's them telling you to shut up. That what they're saying is, I have won over on you because my identity says I find that offensive and you now have to be quiet. That's the first advantage. Secondly, it can mean, because of the way the culture has changed, that you're given certain advantages in the workplace. You're let off certain, egregious behavior. You know, if you can say, well, I, as a member of, and this has then become associated with a set of political demands and outcomes. And that's made it very difficult because if you're somebody like me, who's from an anti-racist background, who's fought for women's rights, who fought for lesbian and gay rights, suddenly to find myself involved in a situation in which the greatest censors in society are using the mantle of anti-racism and saying we need to stop that discussion over there because it will offend ethnic minorities. We must stop that discussion over here because it will offend this identity group and so on and so forth. You are accused of being a right-wing bigot who's insensitive to oppression if you argue against the censorship. And that's had a chilling effect on, you know, we haven't been able to have a battle of ideas because too many people have been worried that they will be cast into this role of, you know, prejudice and bigotry. And they've kind of been a bit wary of that. So they've self-censored and become silenced. And we will know that there's been certain peak points of this around Black Lives Matters or so on and so forth. But it's also incentivized young people in particular who've not got very much history by way of, say, anti-racism or fighting for the struggles on against oppression, fighting for equal rights. They have bought or been sold, rather, a very corrupted, distorted, bastardized version of what progressive politics are. And imagine that in order to prove that you are an anti-racist, you have to go along with what, for example, the Muslim identity group representative, who, by the way, has never been voted in by any Muslims, but, you know, the people who are considered to be representative of all Muslims, you have to go along with that, or you might be accused of Islamophobia, and you think that makes you an anti-racist. Whereas actually what it does is it makes you give up your autonomous right to be critical. It means that you cannot say, I disagree with that. You therefore end up with a kind of suite of opinions that you have to tick box your way through to prove your radical progressive credentials that does not require you doing anything other than repeating a cut and paste version of reality. You don't have to think for yourself because those correct opinions have been agreed by the different oppressed groups. And then the final point on this is everybody then looks for an identity that will get them into a position where they can join in this kind of oppression Olympics. And so you get the burgeoning of identity groups. So what started off as, you know, quite a narrow group of groups, now everybody's at it, as it were. And of course, some identity groups have become mired in huge controversy, the way that, for example, people who are transgender have attached themselves to the lesbian and gay bisexual community. And there is a big row in the UK about what there's no relationship between those two things. But we know that we can't offend in relation to transgender, because that really is become a sacred issue, that if you do that, it's like the old days, you know, of religion, which is that really is something that will lead you to be sent to hell. And we've got into a complete confusion about what a legitimate identity is. But even if you've got an identity, these things are a way of denying your capacity to transcend your identity. You know, one of the great Enlightenment insights for me was that prior to the Enlightenment, and this is the worst history lesson I'm ever going to give, you know, we had kind of feudalism, but where everybody was fixed in their identity and told, you know, if you're a serf, you're a serf. You know, if you're a knight, you're a knight. If you're a damsel in distress, if you're a peasant, you're a peasant. There was no movement on this. This was God-given, God-ordained from on top. The great gain of the Enlightenment, one of the great gains, was the recognition that every individual could transcend that predetermined, fated existence and could make themselves, could create themselves, be self-determining. We have abandoned that and gone back to pre-Enlightenment thinking of fixed identity status as a bargaining tool in modern life. And that has been very damaging for critical thinking and freedom of expression and thought.
No, no, really, really. So, you know, in the end of this talk, what can we do? That's the big question. Will it be enough to say, okay, we have this academy of ideas, or we have the battle of ideas, we believe in it? I, for example, believe in it really, really so much that I think that in the end, rationalism and science as a method to search the better solution for a problem will win. But sometimes I doubt that, to be honest. Sometimes I think maybe irrationalism and emotion and ideology will win. So when you look at your life and your work, what is best to go with? Is it really the argument, do you think?
Well, I think that one of the problems is that cancel culture made cowards of us all. I'm sad to say that the grown-ups in the room, the people who run institutions and people who are in positions of authority, have accommodated to a lot of this. Sometimes they felt themselves such a degree of self-loathing for the institutions they run that they themselves had intellectually abandoned the Enlightenment. You know, many people who run museums in this country had already bought into the kind of post-colonial history. We hate Britain. It's associated with slave trade, you know, all of the things that you're familiar with. Yeah. And they kind of like used young people's, this kind of naive kind of new politics as a kind of, and they kind of used that to justify them destroying the institutions they ran. But a lot of people would be in positions of authority would say, well, what can I do? I've got a lot of 24, 25 year olds who work for me. And I remember being told that by somebody who is leading one of the Europe's top banks. And I said, well, you've got to get a bit of backbone. You run the top bank, right? They're 24, 25 year olds, but they're, you know, people are frightened, right? Well, that's cowardice, I'm afraid. You know, when you think about the things that people have gone through or going through, you know, the Iranian young people who still, the students still going out now. I mean, what would possess you if you're a student in Iran to still go on a demonstration after what's happened to their friends? I mean, that's bravery, right? So I think that we can afford to demand a certain bravery of speaking out from people who run institutions. So I think that we need to have more courage and bravery and speak out. And the reason I'm saying that is because, you know, if we sort of say, well, why are young generations like this? Well, they haven't had much of a lead, right? We haven't argued with them. It's not just an argument, but, you know, cowardice can be contagious, but so can courage. And what we've tried to do, I mean, by the way, it's not easy. I'm not being glib. I'm not suggesting for 1 minute that this is easy, but we have an obligation, in my view. You know, the kind of things that we've tried to do at the Academy of Ideas, we've got a project, a sister project called Living Freedom for 18 to 30-year-olds, which is intending to, which is basically encouraged, because there is a bit of a backlash, a minor backlash amongst the young who are beginning to say, this is intolerable, you know, stifling, we can't stand it. And of course, they are heading in the direction of pretty right-wing forces, because they're the only people who've spoken out. And so we're kind of, we put on Living Freedom very much as an opportunity to both educate, because we do history and philosophy of ideas of free speech and things like that. but also to present moral dilemmas, to have open and frank discussions, to not condemn them if they're a bit censorious, to try and discuss those. So we do that annually, and it's been a great success. We even run a debating competition for 16 to 18 year olds, and that's much more basic, which is substance over style debating rather than just kind of rhetorical nonsense. But where we're basically saying to 16 to 18 year olds, there are two sides to any story. There might even be three or four, but you know, there's definitely two. And that you can't assume, you know, this debate topic, there isn't a right answer. And we provide them with readings, or equally weighted readings on both sides, to show, well, look, you know, I know you think that, but look, this is really legitimate arguments against that. And we put on a big festival called the Battle of Ideas Festival, which when we started it, by the way, which was 20 years ago now, it had the slogan Free Speech Allowed. But honestly, I never thought about it. It was just a slogan, you know, it's just a... That's now become like a revolutionary slogan. And we now have in London once a year, and with lots of growing numbers of satellite events associated with it. But in London, we now have 120 panel discussions, 400 plus speakers, 3,500 people attending of all ages, including the young, I'm just stressing, and of all different social backgrounds and ethnicities, but without box ticking. And we basically have a public conversation, and even our speakers, even if they're very famous and they're on a panel, they still only get 5 or 6 minutes each, because the idea is that it's a public conversation. And mm-hmm. I think one of the things that we do need to do is to acknowledge that we have, as a generation, forgive me for including you in this, but certainly my generation and generations after me, in fact, have been complacent. You know, academics at good universities thought all of this nonsense about deplatforming and no platforming and cancel culture were happening at kind of rubbish universities, and they didn't need to worry. It would never affect them. That's what they really genuinely thought. They argued with me that I was exaggerating. Well, they were more than wrong, because in fact, the elite institutions have become most corrupted most easily. I mean, I have to say that's where all the problems are, and so on and so forth. So we have to admit the complacency has created a real problem for ourselves. We haven't done anything mm-hmm. about this for too long. But when you do, and this is where maybe it's more hopeful, you know, grassroots organisations in this country have totally changed the conversation on transgender ideology. I'm trying to avoid getting you involved in this, but transgender ideology, not transgender people, transgender ideology, which basically declares no debate and that you have to accept it, and you are forced in a coerced mm-hmm. way, through coercive speech, to say that a man who says that they're a woman is a woman. And if you're a woman, you might not want to do that, right? But grassroots organisations have changed the conversation, even changed the law or clarified the law. And that was a bottom-up moment. Grassroots organisations, similarly in the UK, have made it more difficult for the police to impose, well, in fact, it's going to go. The police were turning up at people's doors, and they were, this is not an Elon Musk myth, and coming in and saying, you tweeted this. What? You tweeted this? The police, and I mean police vans and officers saying, or you wrote this in a WhatsApp group. What? And these were like, and then they would say, well, it might not be a crime, but we're investigating you, and we're going to issue with you with a non-crime hate incident report. So the police were investigating non-crimes. Non-crimes. Now, that's become a big scandal in this country. The police have now become very defensive, and the government, even, who are not keen on free speech, in my opinion, are saying, even they are saying this is ludicrous and a waste of police time and harassment. That was caused by grassroots organisations, by our Battle of Ideas Festival, by making a big fuss about this, by a small group, you know, minority, going onto the media, talking about it, exposing to the, you know, to the disinfectant of sunshine. You know, these ordinary people were saying that's ridiculous, because one of the problems is that if you're accused, for example, of racism at work, and that, by the way, is a definite, you know, racism, and I'm a passionate anti-racist, but racism is now such a broad concept that you can be accused of racism for saying the wrong word out of place. And I don't mean the most egregious racial slurs. I mean just something that somebody defines as racism. Or because you didn't invite someone for lunch. I mean, you'd be amazed, right? Or, you know, any number of things. Or because you won't, because you said, you tweeted that you don't think that people, women should be forced to wear the full burqa with no, you know, somebody was suspended from work for that and accused of racism. The problem is, if that happens to you as an individual, just a Joe Bloggs individual, right? Not me, but, you know, I'm sort of in the public sphere. You don't necessarily tell everyone, right? I know teachers at the moment have been accused of terrible thought crimes. They're suspended. First of all, they're not told why. They sit at home, they're anxious, they're worried. Then they find out they don't necessarily want to tell anyone because they've got a reputation. And they're frightened that if they tell people, that maybe people will think there's no smoke without fire, that maybe something has happened. If they actually go to the press, they're sacked because the workplace says, oh, you've breached confidentiality and gone to the press. So it's only through people like me and, you know, other people in this country. We have the Free Speech Union as well. But there are other, I mean, I don't want to take any, you know, we're one of a group of kind of, we like to say that our Battle of Ideas Festival is like a mothership to all these different grassroots organisations. But it's only when people like us talk out and explain the detail that the British public realise what's going on. And otherwise, these things are dirty little secrets that people don't share for understandable reasons, because they don't want people to know that they've been accused of bigotry. Because the vast majority of people in this country are decent, law-abiding, non-bigoted, non-prejudiced people. Yes, some of them might be worried about illegal migration and people turning up on boats. They might be worried about the lack of integration in certain areas because Muslim communities have become completely closed off and refusing to integrate. These are legit. We should be able to discuss this in a democracy. It's our country. We're allowed to say, are you worried about that, without the police turning up at your door or somebody in your workplace reporting you, and you then being cast out and demonised and sometimes criminalised as being, you know, a hate criminal.
Okay, yeah. So, but, well, I must thank you for your passion. I feel it through the screen for your passion and your, you know, it's sincere. You have this battle. We are in Switzerland. We have this magazine, Schweizer Monat. We are publishing now in March a whole number about free speech, the society that we live in, that we want to live in and not to live in. And this is part of our conversation, is the publication of this magazine in March. And it will be published also in English with our partners. You will get a copy. I would like to repeat in the final of this talk two really, really important things you said. So there is a bravery and there is, you know, courage, and it can spread. It is possible to spread for bravery and courage among people, among our societies. That's the one thought. It's very important, but because often when you consume medias, and I'm a media man, and you read and you see all these negative things, you know, all this, yeah, it's too late, and, you know, we are going to die without spitting out. This is not true. It's not true, and I like that you said it. It can spread bravery and courage. That's the one thing. And the other thing, to be silent and to be a coward will not save you. It will not save you. In the end, revolution eats its children. It's always like that. So that's, I think it's important to
absolutely
say, no?
Absolutely. And I think there's an audience. That's the thing. I'm delighted you're doing the magazine. I did want to say, when you are courageous, the number of people who come up and say, oh, thank God you said that. I thought I was going mad. I've been banging my head against the wall. I thought I was the only one who saw it. And historically, think of what people have done for freedom. They have put their lives on the line. In other words, there's an instinct in us. I really believe that.
So
it's not just a philosophical cultural heritage.
No,
there's an instinct that we do not want to be slaves.
No, we don't know. Anson, trust your instinct. If you see this talk, trust your instinct. Be free. Thank you. Thank you, Clara or Baroness Fox of Buckley. Thank you for this talk. It was a pleasure.